let's get started. We're returning to our study of Ephesians, and you can open your Bibles there to Ephesians chapter 4, verse 17. Just as kind of like an introduction or kind of reorient ourselves to the last half of Ephesians. We were seeing in our study as we kind of throughout the last year as we're kind of going through Ephesians 4, 1 to 16, what we said when we first started this little study. We were just talking about how a concern for holiness permeates every aspect of our lives, and I just want to show you that walking through the rest of Ephesians 4 through 6, just looking at the rest of those sections. There are basically four main sections ahead that we're going to look at, starting in chapter 4, verse 17. And I just want to just let your eyes kind of glance across those sections as I kind of describe this. This will be very brief, but I just want to get your minds kind of in the flow of what Paul's doing here. So first thing that we see, verses 17 to 24, Paul is calling us here to remember the past. And holiness means in some way that we do remember the past. We do think about what happened back then. We're to remember, we're to examine, and we're even then to forsake our Gentile ways, verses 17 and 19. And we're also to go back to the beginning, what we learned at the outset of our salvation, verses 20 to 24. So this is our immediate material that we're going to be getting into today. The second thing you can see is holiness means we get specific about our sin. That we're not just general, we're not vague, we're not just saying, yeah, we're sinners, all have sinned, fallen short of the glory of God. That's true. But we get specific about it. And you can see that section goes from chapter 4, verse 25, all the way through chapter 5, verse 21. Okay? Chapter 4, verse 25, all the way to chapter 5, verse 21. Just follow with me quickly, just a quick survey of this. Chapter 4, holiness means there that we, verse 25, speak the truth in love. It means verses 26 to 27 that we're angry, we be angry, and yet we do not sin in our anger. Verse 28, holiness means that we don't steal, but holiness means that we do work hard. We get a job, we work hard, we are then earning money that we can be generous with. That's holiness. Chapter 4, verse 29, watch your mouth. Watch how you speak. Verses 30 to 32, holiness means we please God, we treat each other right. And then going into chapter 5, holiness means verses 1 and 2 that we imitate the love of God. It means verses 3 to 6 that there's no sexual immorality, not even a hint of it. Verses 7 to 10, we walk as children of light. We'll talk all about that, how walking in the light means we walk with lives that are transparent, open for scrutiny, open for people's judgment. Verses 11 to 14, holiness means that as we do walk as children of light, we expose the darkness. We our own light sheds light on what's dark, what's kept in dark, in the dark. Verses 15 to 17, as we walk in holiness, it means we walk in wisdom. We are wise, we're judicious, we're discreet, we're thoughtful about how we live our lives. Verses 18 to 21, holiness means that we are filled with the Spirit. We need to be, the verb there is be being filled with the Spirit. We'll talk about that, what all that means. But that's all very specific, very practical, quite probing, holiness. So major sections, remembering the past is the first one. Getting specific about holiness is the second one. Third thing, holiness means personal submission to our God-given roles. See that in verses chapter 5, verse 22, all the way through chapter 6, verse 9. We can include these in the previous point, but really this section unpacks that final verse there, chapter 5, verse 21, submitting to one another in the fear of Christ. So getting specific about holiness through all those things we mentioned, it has a practical impact in how we submit to one another in the fear of Christ, embracing our God-given roles. Holiness means, therefore, verses 22 to 24, that wives submit to their husbands. It means verses 25 to 27, or verse 33, rather, that holiness means that husbands love their wives. Why is that section so long, actually? Husbands, well, they need a lot of coaching, a lot of confrontation there. So continuing chapter 6, holiness means that children obey their parents. Go get the kids out of children's Sunday school. Let them hear that part. Children obey their parents, verses 1 to 3. Holiness also means living a life that's holy. Verse 4, parents discipline their children, raising them in Christian truth. Holiness means, verses 5 to 8, that slaves obey their masters. And verse 9, that masters do good to their slaves. So that's the way, just a brief skimming over that section. Each of these categories of Christians, right there in our roles, we all fall into at least one of those categories: husband, wife, child, parent, slave, master. Some of us, we're all going to fall into something there. That is the way each one of us submits to one another in the fear of Christ. Holy living requires us to submit according to our God-given design, according to our God-given roles, right? So the last thing we said some holiness is remembering the past. Holiness is getting specific about our holiness. Holiness is personal submission in our God-given roles. And the last thing we could say is holiness means putting on the full armor of God. Chapter 6, verses 10 to 20, engaged in real, very real spiritual warfare. We need to learn a biblical approach to that war, lest we fall to every ambush, lest we flail around aimlessly in every battle. This concern for personal holiness, it's going to pervade our entire existence. It's going to pervade every nook and cranny of our lives, every part of our thinking. We're to be holy in what we think, what we say, what we speak, what we do, what we don't do, what we keep ourselves from doing and saying, what we keep ourselves from thinking. We're to be holy in private and public. We're to be holy at home and at work. It's going to determine what we accept, what we reject from the culture. It's going to govern our intergenerational relationships, how the younger treat the older, how the older treat the younger. Holiness in our thoughts, words, behavior, that's what it means to live the Christian life. Very, very practical portion of Paul's letter to the Ephesians. Now, just note that this is not some works salvation. This is not being justified by works. This is not trying to gain God's favor. Paul is writing to people who are already saved. Chapter 1, verse 1, Paul is writing to the saints, those who are set apart as holy by God, those who are saved by grace through faith. Chapter 2, verses 4 to 9. He's writing to those kinds of people. So there's no earning here. There's no trying to get God's favor. You are completely accepted in the Beloved. Chapter 1, verse 6. But it means that if you are accepted in the Beloved, if you are a saint, if you are someone who's been saved by grace through faith, this is how it works out through your life. Okay? Ephesians 2:10 says we are saved for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. So we're not living holy lives to get anything, to gain anything, to gain God's favor, to maintain his approval. We have his approval. He's demonstrated that so clearly when he sent his own son to die on a cross for us. We have it. Everything else is the outworking of a relationship between father and child. Okay? So we are holy. We're saints. The remainder of our time, let's look at Ephesians 4:17 to 19. And I want to start with a few interpretive comments that'll move the ball forward. I'm just going to read the section there and just make a couple comments. Now, Paul says this: "Now this I say, testify in the Lord, that you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do, in the futility of their minds. They're darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them, due to their hardness of heart. They become callous, have given themselves up to sensuality, greedy to practice every kind of impurity." Yuck. Okay? So Paul first starts, he uses this word Gentile. And he doesn't use it like in an ethnic sense, as in Jew versus Gentile, but he uses it in an ethical sense. He uses it in a moral sense. To call someone a Gentile is like we might call him a pagan, someone who's just a pagan sinner. It's essentially a synonym for an unbelieving lifestyle. Okay, so that's how he's using the term Gentile. Secondly, when Paul says, "Now this I say and testify in the Lord," he is invoking the mind and authority of Christ in what follows. And he, as an apostle, speaks with the mind and the authority of Christ, and yet he's trying to make that really, really apparent. This is apostolic authority unveiled, unleashed. He's pulled the sword out, and he's showing you the steel. He wants you to see it. This is the very authority of Christ brought to bear on the issue of separating from Gentile living, Gentile thinking, Gentile pursuits, Gentile entertainments, Gentile everything. Why do you think that Paul feels the need to invoke apostolic authority here? That's the question for you. Now, wait a minute. Were we going to run around with mics? We do have mics. Does someone have a mic? Oh, it's just right here. You want everybody to run to the mic, or do you want people to pass handheld mics? Is this, it looks like it's on a wire. Oh, there's the one. Sorry. Okay, Ryan is going to serve all of us.
Run.
Yeah. So who wants to, okay, so here's the question again. Why do you think Paul feels the need to invoke apostolic authority here? Why is he getting strong? Steve, right?
Right.
Okay, you run, Ryan, run. You're gonna get a workout. All you people sitting in the back, you're gonna make Ryan work. So you need to come closer to the front.
You gotta buy me tennis shoes.
Tennis shoes, okay. Bruce will take care of that. Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
I think it's more of a teaching authority of. Not because he's an apostle, because other places he says he's the least of the apostles and all that, humbly. He was trying to give more of an authority of teaching because they're going to need it for the future of the foundation of Jesus Christ and his kingdom.
Okay, good. Thanks, Ryan. Grab that. And that's a, so Steve, that is absolutely right, that he is trying to set a foundation. That's what we see clearly that the apostolic authority was used for, is to lay a foundation for the church. Clearly, spot on. My question, though, has to do specifically with why he invokes that apostolic, which we know his apostolic authority is there. And you're right that sometimes he calls himself the least of the apostles. He's walking in such, Paul really was. He was walking in such humility that people like the Corinthian church felt free to walk all over him, to despise him, to talk about him being kind of, you know, the least of the apostles. Like, who is this guy? You know, he's not Peter. He's not James. He's not anybody powerful, known. He was despised. But here, and in 2 Corinthians, he does wield his apostolic authority. He says, you want me to come to you in gentleness or with a rod? So sometimes he does pull that thing out and say, here, and here's where he's doing that. Why? I mean, we're in the flow of like, as we talked 2 weeks ago, we said, you know, we're in the flow of this rich church. You know, we're all learning from the teachers and the gifted people, and we're all speaking the truth in love, and each part working properly makes the body grow. And now Paul pulls out the sword of his apostolic authority and says, this I say, testify in the Lord, you must no longer walk the... What is that? Rod, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I'm just going to make a suggestion that in chapter, or the very first part of the chapter 4, it says, walk in a manner worthy of the calling that you have been called. He's now setting the stage for where they came out of.
Yeah.
This is the unbelief. And then as it goes on in verse 20, but this is not the way that you've learned Christ.
Good. Okay. So basically, he is seeing that there is a threat, right, present, of us falling back into walking like Gentiles, right? It's in us. And so this is really, as Paul pulls this thing out and he gets real strong here, it's like your dad, you know, pulling you aside and saying, now listen, son, or listen, little girl, as you go over to college here, I don't want you messing around the frat houses. And he starts messing, you know, really brings it out. Why? Because there's a temptation there. Because the nature, this here is an indication of the depth and the stubbornness of sin in us. We need a warning. We need a warning. And listen, for us as saints, let's just assume every single one of us here, we're in the category of saints, we're all saved here, we're redeemed. Let's not make any mistake of the fact that we are tempted by sin. Well, it does no good to pretend that it doesn't tempt us. It does no good to pretend that it's not habits of thinking and all that kind of stuff are not in there. They are. So Paul's acknowledging that right here. As you look in the Gentile lifestyle described in verses 17 to 19, it's pretty ugly, isn't it? It's kind of repulsive. Just you notice the language in those few verses. He talks about futility, darkness, alienation, ignorance, hardness, callousness, sensual impurity, greed, impurity. Sounds horrid. It sounds dreadful, repulsive. Like, why would anybody want that? And it is repulsive. Remember, we all can remember the sinful lifestyles of our past. You can, if you have doubt about that, you're like, you're raised in the church and you're a good kid, wonderful. That's awesome. But look back at Ephesians 2, 1 to 3 and remember what you were. It says there in Ephesians 1 through 3, you were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you once walked, following the course of the world, following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that's now at work in the sons of disobedience, among whom we all once lived in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the body and the mind, were by nature children of wrath, like the rest of mankind. We were all there. Okay, so if you were raised in church, you say, you know what, I really think I came to faith at 4 years old. My dear mother says that. I'm like, Mom, you did not. You didn't know what was going on at 4 years old. She says, oh yeah, I don't remember a time in my life when Jesus wasn't my friend. So okay, granted. But when you were 3 years old, that's what you were, right there. A child of wrath. And she says, okay, all right, granted. This is what the Bible says. We all live that way. And you see little 2 and 3 year olds living in the passions of their flesh and their mind and carrying out the desires of the body and their mind, right? They're heading the same direction as everybody else. So God, by his grace, snatched my mom when she was 4 and snatched other people too. That's true, but there are some of us who know a little bit more of that, right? So why do you think that Paul portrays the thinking and the lifestyle of the unbeliever in such a vivid, such a stark way? What is he doing here?
You mean a definition of what?
Great. Wait, get a mic, because we need you on. Ryan. You're letting us down. No, I'm just kidding.
Because later on he talks about flesh. So he's giving the definition of the flesh.
Okay, good.
Of what we do.
So he's laying down a definition that he's going to use later on. Like a good teacher, right, Jim?
Absolutely.
Okay, we got a comment over here from Chuck. We need probably 2 mics and 2 people running around.
Oh, I like one. No, I like to see Ryan.
You're a mean man, Chuck. And it says, it describes you right here, actually. No, I'm just kidding.
Second mic right there.
What's that?
Second mic right there.
Even on my lapel? You think I'm going to run around this suit when I got notes right here? Smart aleck. All right, go ahead.
This is Thomas, by the way.
Hey, Thomas, how's it going? We do have a mic, I think, set up right here, so if anybody wants to make their way to the microphone, if you're okay with that. Go ahead, Chuck.
No, I'm just wondering if he's using the strategy of defining something by its negative, defining holiness by what it isn't.
Good, yeah, another teaching technique of defining holiness by contrasting it with its absolute opposite, right? Unholiness. Great, a great comment, yeah. Brandon? No. Leslie?
Warning. I tend to make a lot of feedback with these things.
Well, it must be like some metal in your head or something.
I'm not
going to
go there.
Okay, let's not go there. Past life. Go ahead.
I was also thinking that typically when we look back on previous things in our lives, we tend to soften it a little.
Good.
Try to think, it wasn't quite so bad. I can remember a few ex-girlfriends. She wasn't quite so bad. Then the memory is like, well, why did you next then? So he's trying to point out that, yeah, whether you want to remember it or not, it was this bad, it was this repulsive, it was this ugly.
Yeah, that's a great comment. You know, I just, that is, I think, precise. What you guys said is right, but I think that's kind of more to the point of what Paul's doing. He is the one who is bringing in a sanctified view of what we were to us, okay? Like, you're right, I have certain memories about my life, and I can soften them. And I think that's even like a self-preservation aspect of human nature, that we kind of soften the past. Otherwise, we would be, man, it would be really hard to live. Every year that goes by, it would be really hard to live with yourself, right? If you saw everything in such vivid, stark detail. But we have this tendency to soften ourselves. But if we go back to somebody who was there, we say, hey, describe that for me. Oh, yeah, you were this and that. Yeah, exactly. My wife helps me out with that. You know, her memory is sharp, spot on, remembering what exactly I said and how I said it. And sometimes we need that. But even more objective than my wife's memory is God. Paul takes this futile, wicked mindset of this unbeliever and the ugly consequences of sinful living, And he drags all that into the harsh, bright light of truth that is unforgiving and makes no apologies, puts it on that, lays it on the, kind of like on the operating table, so you can see it for what it is. He strips away any masquerade of an attractive veneer that's on sin that tempts us originally. He strips that all away. He reveals the masquerade. He clears away that mirage that's there, and he shows us sin for what it is. That is useful to us, isn't it? A life without holiness is not cool. It's not freedom. It's not liberation from oppressive mores and taboos in the culture. It is futile. It is foolish. It's filthy. It's ugly. It's destructive. Holiness, though, is true freedom. Holiness is freedom. So if we know that, why do we tend to drift back into sin? Why do we do that? I mean, let's be honest. We do find ourselves at times attracted to sin and the sinful ways of the world, right? Not all of them. Each of us have different things, but Paul's strong admonition here, verse 17, you must no longer, by no means, walk as Gentiles do. That assumes we're tempted. That assumes that we might be tempted to do that, to walk in those ways. But why would we? Why are we tempted with all that is so clearly ugly and destructive and unholy? Thoughts? Paulette, no, you gotta use a mic. I appreciate those of you who answer right away, but I want to get some of the rest of you talking, okay? Paulette.
For me, sometimes it's just laziness because it's easier to fall into that pattern, back into that pattern, than try to establish a new pattern
Good.
Or take a stand.
So she's saying sometimes it's laziness that we just kind of don't feel like attending to the temptations. So we just kind of give in, go with it. Run back to Mike there. Now, you know, and just on that point, John Owen, in talking about sin, he describes our hearts as a garden that you'd need to weed and fertilize and tend to every single day. He says, you let one day go, the weeds come. They start to crop up. If you let it go too often, 2 days, the weeds get bigger, stronger. They start to choke out real life. We cannot be lazy about our gardens. We cannot be lazy about our hearts. Mike.
I think sometimes, too, it could be a lack of faith in certain areas.
Okay.
As to why we fall back into sin. I know personally, I like to think of 1 Corinthians 10:13 every time I have an inkling of falling back into sin and temptation, that God will always provide a way out that we can stand up under it.
Right, good. Yeah, so just having faith, just trusting God. In fact, to piggyback on that, trusting God that holiness is better than unholiness, because sometimes we're tempted by holiness and it's like a belief that that's going to be better for ourselves. That's what Eve fell into. That's what we've all fallen into. We think that his way, what he's describing for us, what Satan's painting a picture for us, that that's reality, that that's good, that that's fun, that's enjoyable, that really provides satisfaction, pleasure, comfort, whatever. No. We need to trust God. Okay, so let me move on here just a little bit. I'm seeing the time. Sunday after Christmas, it was Communion Sunday, we talked about the Christian's three enemies, the world, the flesh, and the devil. We talked about how the world and the devil are outside of us, and the only way that they can actually be effective inside of us is through the flesh. That's the avenue. That's the enemy within. That's the betrayer inside of us. It's the pattern of thinking. It's the desiring, the behaving, all that stuff we used to have in our unregenerate condition. Devil's all around us, culture's all around us, but all of this focuses on the flesh. Notice in verse 17 and 18, notice how many terms here are focused on the mind, the thinking. The futility of their minds, it says there. Verse 18, darken in their, what? Understanding. Ignorance is a term that, you know, the ignorance is in them, the hardness of their heart, all that refers to it's the inner life of us. Depravity here is profound. It's not just things we do, it's ways we think. It's our thinking. It goes deep into the personality to affect the thinking, the reasoning, the desires, the affections. When you go beyond verses 17 to 19, you look at verse 20, you say, that's not the way you learn Christ. Verse 21, you've heard, you were taught. So learned, heard, taught, all those things are targeting the brain, targeting the mind, targeting the spirit, the heart, the understanding on the inside. Verse 22, be renewed in the spirit of your minds. So if depravity is internal thoughts and stuff like that, well, that's what holiness deals with first, is dealing with those internal thoughts, all the thinking. Holiness is profound. It renews what depravity destroyed, and it starts in the mind. It starts in the mind. At the core of what it is to be human, at the core of what it is to be created in the image and the likeness of God, is to think